Hi, all. I just wanted to hop on really quick before this episode started and give a quick trigger warning. So obviously we talk about purity culture trauma, we talk about sexism and misogyny, and then we talk quite a bit about rape, sexual assault, and marital rape. And we talk about it at two points in the episode. I've timestamped both in the episode notes. And then we also talk about abusive relationships, coercion, manipulation, controlling dynamics, abusive power, church abuse, and there's a brief mention of suicide. And I'm sure as you've noticed, we have the wonderful Sarah back. I had such an overwhelming response to our first purity culture episode, and people were very excited to have us talk again. And so we decided that we'd have another conversation. And then separately, I did a poll on my Instagram about whether or not you guys wanted to hear about the pipeline from religion to abusive relationships. And the answer was overwhelmingly yes, and overwhelmingly that you guys wanted it with a guest. And so I thought, what better guest to talk about this with than Sarah? So we have Sarah back on. It's a phenomenal conversation. It's actually very humorous, which I appreciate when we're talking about heavy shit and it gets funny. So it's very fun to listen to, very educational. It's also like almost a 2-hour episode because Sarah and I can talk forever. So buckle up. But it's a really great episode. If you are triggered at all by abusive relationships, especially coming out of religion, this might not be the episode for you. But if you are wanting to have some relatable content and learn a little bit more about your background in religion, this might be the episode for you. So anyways, I hope you guys enjoy. And yeah, here we go. Hi, all, and welcome back to Mindful Minds. Thank you so much for joining us today. Today we have Sarah LaCour back of at Deconstructing Purity Culture, and we are going to be talking about the religion to abusive relationship pipeline. How are you?
Good. It's a fun intro.
So excited.
Yeah.
Well, for those of you who haven't heard episode 61, Sarah came on in January, and we did a pretty deep dive into purity culture. It was like an hour and 30 minutes or something like that. And we got really into kind of the nitty gritty of purity culture, and specifically purity culture 2.0, and kind of dived into what it looks like now. And we've received a lot of feedback from people about really enjoying this episode and wanting more about purity culture. And so we wanted to kind of take a little bit of a different approach to it and not just do like a full deep dive again, but go into specifically how purity culture can impact and lead to abusive relationships, which was on our original outline for the first episode, and we just never got there.
Couldn't quite get there.
Yeah, no, there's too much. And so if you guys haven't listened to episode 61, this is a little bit of a part two if you're looking for more of just a baseline. What is purity culture? How does it impact people? What does it look like now? Why is it bad? We unpack a lot of that in episode 61. And so this is a kind of a follow-up. And for those of you who haven't listened to that, Sarah, do you want to give a little bit of background into you and your page?
Sure. I'm Sarah. And like you said, I run like an Instagram account just called at Deconstructing Purity Culture. And I'm a physical therapist on like from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. And then on the evenings and weekends, I run this Instagram account, and I started it. It's been actually 2 years, like this month. And I just kind of started it as a way to like process some stuff that I was like learning and feeling and like working through in therapy. And then it really resonated with a lot of people. And so I thought it was just going to be like my friends or a few people that I knew in real life. And they started sharing it with people, and it just kind of took off. And so here we are talking about sex on the internet all
yep,
the time.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's only been 2 years, because your page has grown like exponentially in 2 years. That's like really crazy. In my mind, I thought it'd been around much longer.
No, it's just been 2 years, because it was 2021. And people think that it's much bigger. People think that I'm like, that it's more than just me, or that I have like a company. I'm like, no, it's just me on the weekends, like in Canva, typing some stuff.
Literally. I had someone DM me on like LinkedIn recently and be like, oh, how long have you been doing graphic design? And I was like, I taught myself how to use Canva because I started a blog when I was like 17, and then started a podcast 2 years ago and realized, oh shit, I need to know how to make graphics. And so I figured it out. And yeah, I also have a completely separate job that actually, my job now is I actually do podcast produce, but that was
not my original job. I started this as a little fun. I'm lonely and it's the pandemic and I want to talk to adults and see if we can unpack some shit that Christianity taught me. But yeah, so for people who, I mean, do we want to do a tiny bit of a crash course on just what purity culture is, just in case people haven't listened to episode 61? So we can get a little bit of background.
So the purity culture that we're kind of specifically talking about, because it does exist like outside of the church and everything, and it's kind of a broad term, but the purity culture that we're talking about is the like American evangelical church. And I know it also spread apparently to like the UK and Australia, New Zealand, but, it was like from the 80s to like early 2000s, there was this idea, in the church of really emphasizing abstinence only education, and so much so that there was federal funding to accomplish that. And it encompassed like purity balls, purity contracts, where you were basically saying that you would not have sex until marriage, but then it also encompassed modesty and trying not to tempt people in any way and controlling all of your sexual thoughts and feelings until your eventual monogamous heterosexual marriage. And it has changed form over the past few years with social media and become a little bit more, almost a little bit more dangerous, just because it has, a lot of purity culture influencers have figured out how to change their content to not be as fear-based, because the purity culture that a lot of us grew up with was very, very fear-based and also used a lot of like really harmful object lessons and like phrases and stuff, like names for us and things like that, that they don't really use anymore. But now it just kind of takes the form of very restrictive sexual values that they want to impose on literally everyone. And it's worked its way into legislature now. So that's fun.
Yeah. And it's definitely, I definitely think it's more dangerous now. Because it's just not as, it's crafty as shit. Like it really is. It's very crafty. It's very sneaky. And when I was talking to, we were just talking about, I want to give them a shout out, actually. We were just talking about a film club decided to discuss our last episode at their film club meeting, which is the coolest thing in the whole world. But they're called plot.twist.film.club on Instagram. Plot Twist Film Club is like what they're called, but that's their at. And we, when we were talking about the episode, a lot of them were just like, I had no idea that this was such a business, that there was so much capitalistic gain wrapped up in purity culture. And I kind of was explaining that from my perspective in my deconversion, I have realized more and more, especially growing up in a megachurch, like I grew up in a megachurch, I like served in a megachurch and served, quote unquote, worked for free. and I realized more and more as an adult, like, oh, this is a business. And as I started, cause I now work in marketing and started realizing like, oh, there are so many similarities. Yeah. Like it really is. And here's the thing. That's not necessarily, if you look at the church as a business, it's like, of course they have marketing. Like that makes sense. It's a business. Of course they have marketing, but people love to like really try to stick churches in this, like, no, like it's a place of worship. It's a, like almost like a nonprofit. And it's like, oh no, false. It's very for profit, but in very sneaky ways. And, and then when you break down, maybe you have a pastor that is working in more of a volunteer-esque lens, but maybe then they start releasing books and CDs and they have their podcast and they have, they're a mega influencer now. And then they have merch. And then like, I remember, there was one pastor and I think it was the pastor for Mosaic MSC that released, merch that was like, this might be bullshit. Cause I'm now that I'm saying it, I was like, I should probably check before I just like throw out a random number and like slander someone. But I'm almost positive, it was him because he released this like huge, 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 merch collection. It is him. Okay. I was like, okay, I can back it up. So Erwin McManus, released this huge, merch collection that was, like It's not even merch. It's like, it's not a
fashion. He's going to say it's a fashion line.
Yes. No. But it's not like Mosaic MSC. You go to their merch on their website. It's called McManus Gallery. And his about section is like, it's been 10 years in the making. Like, a signature brand is born, bringing together the heroism of the past with a vision for the future. December 4th, 2020, Erwin Raphael McManus launched his inaugural collection. The inspiration came out of the conviction that with God, there's nothing wasted, and it's sustainability. So it has like vintage and like World War II military materials and luxury fabrics. ERN,
which is probably not sustainable.
He goes by an acronym, which is fucking hilarious. ERM believes that elegance and beauty are a reflection of God's created design. And here's the crazy manipulation. I know 2020 has been a challenging year for all of us. No. 2020 must now become more than a year. It is a declaration that nothing is wasted. AKA, to heal your pandemic trauma. Buy my shit. And here's the crazy stuff. Are we ready? No. Three packs of socks, $100.
No. Three and that's all packs just that's just going socks. Just to him. That's just going yes. all back straight this is, into him.
We've got a backpack for $1,200. We have a baklava for baklava.
We have a Greek pastry.
We have a balaclava for $450. And like a lot of this is sold out, which is insane. We have a bucket hat for $378. The socks individual, it's like a pair of socks is $45 a piece. We have a multiple coats and hoodies for over $1,200.
Who is buying this?
I don't know. And Mosaic MSC, by the way, I believe is based somewhere in California.
It's somewhere in California.
I don't remember where, but it's somewhere in California. And so people will often try to be like, well, my church does this. And it's like, oh, so it's LA. There you go.
Well, that makes more sense.
But like, it's just one of those things where, I remember more and more accounts were calling out. I mean, of course, you have the
preachers and sneakers.
Yep. And you have the talking about like, oh, this is crazy that, you know, they have everyone's wearing Gucci. And I remember one of the reasons why I started to really drift away from my church was I went to a mega church and we rented out this massive concert venue. I'm talking like a concert venue that like the concert venue in the city that I grew up in is a city, and it's literally the concert venue that like if Jay-Z and Beyonce come to the town, that's where they play.
Oh my God.
And we rented out that concert venue and did this huge like church event, like this huge concert, and had like big artists come. And my like
passion,
pastor
kind of?
Kind of, yeah. But it was like the poor man's passion. Like it was not quite as like well
the same like concept
fashion.
Of renting out a stadium basically
and we had like it was a one night event, so it wasn't like a multiple day conference, so it really was like the poor man's passion. We had like I think for King and Country came. I think that was like the big band that we had was like for King and Country, and that was like a really big deal.
That's crazy.
And my pastor got on stage and had like Gucci shoes and a Gucci belt and like a custom Gucci jacket, and I was like, what the fuck? Like it like, oh, and he like came on to do the, you know, at all those conferences, if you go to like a Hillsong conference or Passion, they have the little like, we love poor people, like bring out World Vision and we're going to like send out
the
babies.
They're, and they're sponsored by Compassion, International and World Vision a lot of times.
Yep. And so they were doing something along that lines. I think it was World Vision because my church has some ties to World Vision. Okay. Cause World Vision is also, I'm from Washington. And World Vision
is from Washington. I didn't realize that.
We have some ties with them, and I think it was World Vision was doing like, and like he walks out like his Gucci shit, and I was just like, it literally was like a little bit of an out of body, like something feels wrong.
Like, this doesn't feel right.
Yeah. And so we talked a little bit about the purity culture aspect, and they were just, when we were talking about with this film club, they were explaining, oh, I didn't think about it being a business. And for me, when you look at it as this kind of cult-like business, it all starts to really click in and make sense to my brain of, oh, well, of course, if your goal is money and you're mm-hmm. trying to make money off of this, of course it would make sense that you would kind of lock all of these people in your community in this one headspace where it's like, mm-hmm. shame, 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 shame. Here, pay us money. Shame, 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 yeah. shame, shame. Control, 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 control. And it yeah. gets incredibly cult-like. And then it makes sense that from the religion to abuse pipeline, that then
yeah.
your next step as an adult, even if you leave religion, is to find an environment mm-hmm. that is still controlling, cult-like, yeah. shameful, and you just kind of transfer from one environment to another. So yeah. that was all a very long-winded way to like set this up, but I forgot about the Rowan McManus thing until just now. And that was like a thing that got crazy. Called out like early 2020 or early 2021.
I remember it was because of an Easter service. It was like what he wore to an Easter service. And yeah. then it just kind of spiraled from there into like, hey, this doesn't look great.
Well, and Rowan McManus is also an odd pastor because he uh-huh. really leans into the like, I'm an artist and I'm a poet.
Yeah.
And like, he's just yeah. like very like, he's kind of like the art bro at like an LA party yeah. that like you really don't want to hang out with, but like yeah. he's a pastor. And so yeah. it's like, it's a nightmare. Like it's the worst yeah, thing like, you can imagine.
Going to talk to you about art, but also tell you that you're going to hell. So
he has like the worst combination in the whole world. Oh my God. But I remember like we read an Rowan McManus book at my, cause oh. I went to a Christian college and we read his book same. As a part of a class. That was part of our curriculum.
Oh
and
my God.
I remember it was just like, he was like, so, and this was also right in the height of like Tremble had come out and like, that oh. was like rocking yeah. churches all over the world.
Yeah.
And so we're singing Tremble at our chapels and then we're reading yeah. Rowan McManus in school. And like, I remember there were so many kids and myself included that it was like, this is such a cool way to approach God. Like just viewing it from this like artistic lens.
Cause it's different.
So interesting. Yeah. And in my mind, I just like assumed that he was not in the mega church bullshit circle.
Yeah.
In my head, I was like, no, he like believes that like Jesus is in nature and like, that, yeah. like this is art. And I was just like, no, this is so cool. And in my head, I'm like, no, this guy's awesome. And then I remember like in 2021, like that coming out and I was like, oh my God, he's oh. one of them. Like I was scammed. Yeah. This is a scam.
Well, cause he also wasn't doing the thing at the time that all that stuff like, was like, I mean, before it came out at the time, he wasn't doing the conservative American,
no,
like Jesus is a Republican thing. Like he no, wasn't yeah. tied to Christian nationalism. And so it was like a different, like, oh, this is so refreshing. Like, this is so nice.
And kind of speaks to the progressive side too, where you almost think that yeah. someone is progressive because they're yeah. not blatantly racist, homophobic and just absolutely egregious as a human. And
the
so you're like, oh my God,
the
maybe they're progressive. And it's
yeah.
like, no, he's like a multimillionaire who's trying to like fund yeah. his lifestyle and like is doing it in this like very weird roundabout, like
yeah.
sneaky, crafty
it's
way.
Very Righteous Gemstones-y.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's all, just, I mean, it's yeah. all just incredibly manipulative. And we're going to talk about yeah. the manipulation very much so in this episode because it mm-hmm. really plays into a lot of it. But do you want to unpack a little bit of the first part of talking about the authoritarian model and just the kind of yeah. no questions, just yeah. respect narrative yeah. that we get taught?
There, like when I was first thinking about it, I realized there tends to be this attitude in a lot of like modern evangelical, especially mega churches, but in most churches that like if a pastor is quote unquote called to ministry, they must have a higher understanding of the Bible or like regardless if they went to seminary, it's still they must know what they're talking about. They have a close connection with God. They have a special God phone. Like they have this connection that nobody else has and they can understand scripture or they know how to interpret things that we like us mere mortals in the congregation can't interpret. And it doesn't help that with social media and like celebrity pastors, they now don't just have the attention of like their congregation, but they have the attention of the entire world if they want to. And then they turned it, you know, they can make it into a business if they want to. And it's seen as like a good thing because they are evangelizing or they're furthering the gospel. And it's the sneaky, like, oh, they're a Christian, so they must be good. Like in, like when people like sneak in that they're a Christian, like when they're celebrities and stuff. And it was that whole idea. And at the same time, like, we have this idea in our heads of like, and pastors, some pastors will also put it in your heads that like, this is what a typical abusive or bad pastor looks like, that they are like taking your money, or like Joel Osteen is thrown around a lot, and they're cult leaders, or they're grifters, or they like, they don't care about you. They're always, they have, right. Security teams and all this kind of stuff. And so there's a lot of pastors that will say like, I'm not like that. I care about you. And a lot of mega church pastors have found a way to like skirt around, like the idea of kind of what an abusive pastor looks like, or what abuse even looks like within a church. Right. And they weaponize their interpretation of the Bible to justify their behavior and make their church look good and make themselves look good, especially on like social media and to the world and stuff. And the other big thing is like, because of all that, they really truly believe that they are not wrong. Like that, that because, like this happened recently with the pastor in Texas who told that like really objectifying story about a woman on, yeah, like on
from
like,
the pulpit.
From the pulpit, and then doubled yeah. down and finally apologized last week. But it took like 3 weeks of people calling him out and his own, you know, like other pastors and stuff calling him out. But it's this idea of like, no, I know, like I have the only right answer clearly mm-hmm. because I have this connection with God. And I remember being taught this too. I remember like thinking this at growing mm-hmm. up that we were the right ones and everybody else was wrong. And so if someone's oh, yeah. offended by something that you say or do, it's because they don't love Jesus, or they're not a Christian, or they're just trying to take down Christians. We're always persecuted. And so it builds up this like weird ego in a lot of like big celebrity pastors' minds that they can never be wrong because they have all the answers in the Bible and Jesus, and anyone that's offended by them or calling them out or saying that they're wrong is clearly just trying to take them down and just trying to like stop their furthering of the gospel. And so it like, it just builds them up so, so much that they, I mean, for some of them, they just don't ever think that they can say anything wrong. And it takes like people within their own, not even their own congregation, but sometimes within their own like pastoral staff calling them out to make them apologize. But most of the time they don't apologize and they just keep going saying like, I'm right. Everyone else is wrong. And you just have to deal with that. And that's not healthy.
No. Yeah, no, yeah. Probably not. And I think the thing that's really interesting is I've seen the phrase Christian supremacy has come up a lot more in the past few years. We're talking about the whole idea of like Christians are superior to everyone else, period. And I think the thing that's really interesting is, and I want to clarify too, that like all of this harms anyone and everyone in the church. It disproportionately harms people who were raised as women in the church because of the very egregious like patriarchal imbalance that is just rooted in evangelical Christianity. And so I think the thing that's so interesting is you're often puffing up, you puff up everyone. Everyone is like told that like the Bible is right and like you can't be wrong. But then at the same time, there is a hierarchy of like men are in positions of leadership and in power. And so they are kind of inherently higher on the ladder than women. And I'm speaking in binaries because non-binaries don't exist in the church. Like they don't recognize non-binaries and not non-binaries as like, I mean non-binaries in total, not just in gender.
Everything is black and white. There is no gray area. There's no nuance with anything.
Yeah, everything is binary. And so
they
don't recognize the non-binaries in any aspect. It's everything has got to be one thing or the other. And so with gender, it obviously is represented that way as well. And so men get pumped up and their egos get puffed up. And often the only way that a man in the church will actually be humble or humble, quote unquote, or admit their wrongdoing is if another man calls them out who is also in a position of leadership. And so I think when we're talking about abusive relationships, if you're in a partnership that should be an equal partnership with another person, and they have been taught that the only people who can tell them they're doing something wrong, who can call them out, hold them accountable, bring something to their attention is another man. If you are in a heterosexual relationship and you're the woman in the relationship and your very evangelical Christian partner has been taught that honestly, the opinions of women mean less, it creates an environment where there's a power imbalance in your relationship as well, even if your partner isn't the pastor. Because it's not like just the abuse exists in like pastoral marriages, which I'm sure it fucking does. But like if you're raised in an environment where you're constantly taught that pastors who are almost always men are the authority, mm-hmm. it just keeps, you know, reinforcing this idea that men are the authority. And there's also like the whole respect to your parents. And it kind of mm-hmm. always gets, in my opinion, a lot of more emphasis gets put on respect your father than respect your mother. Yeah. Like there's always more emphasis on that. And it was something that I grew up with a lot, was like my dad would be acting in ways that weren't okay. And he would whip out mm-hmm. the respect to your parents. And mm-hmm. I, at one point when I was 15, was like, I'm not respecting you because you haven't earned it. Like you haven't earned it. And so, no, like that's not fair. And we've since talked as adults and he's like, yeah, no, like I just like whipped that out whenever I felt out of control. And like, it wasn't fair because I didn't deserve your respect in that moment. Like I was being awful and like you didn't need to respect me, just blindly respecting me because I'm telling you to, like I hadn't earned it. And if anything, I was violating your respect and violating your trust.
Yeah.
But I used it because it was like I'm out of control. I'm out of control. Well, I know if I use this, I can get back. I can get the control back because I can just, you know, whip her right back into shape. And I was just a little bit too chaotic of a child. And I was also like, I was not neurotypical and would just kind of like fly off the handle sometimes. And so he would use that. And I just like pop back and be like, well, you haven't earned it. And he's like, the control was not gone.
That wasn't what you were supposed to say.
but it really does. Like my dad wasn't a pastor, but like it, we heard that narrative in our household a lot. And I heard it in my schools because I grew up in all religious schools from ages 3 to 15. And then I got 2 years of public school. And then I was in a private Christian college. So it was like constantly reiterated to me, even if it's not blatant. Cause I think that people assume that unless your church is saying men are superior, women fucking suck, you guys have to do everything that we say. It's like, oh, well, unless my church is saying those really obvious, blunt things, my church must not be abusive, which we know is not the case.
Yeah. I, decided. So I recently got blocked on Twitter by Mark Driscoll, and it is, I'll tell you that.
Shut up. The dream. Are you kidding me?
I have no idea how, because I have never responded to anything.
Well,
of his.
We just
I've never tweeted at
him in the last podcast episode.
I don't know.
Literally
who knows?
Just shit talked him.
Maybe
Mark
Driscoll
listen to Mindful Minds.
Maybe
Holy
he
shit.
Does. Hey, Mark. you haven't blocked me on Instagram yet. And so I did take a peek. And it's a mess. His Instagram is, it's wild.
Well, I'm gonna look. I'm interested.
Yeah. So a lot of, this brought this to my mind because you said that, you know, a lot of churches will say that just because they're not saying like men are in charge and women, you need to, you know, fall in line with your husbands or whatever. What they're doing is they're calling women Jezebels, which he does say quite a bit. He loves that term. They're saying that they're calling feminism evil. They're calling.
Oh, sorry. That just started playing. Okay. No.
There's a few where he does just scream. But they're reiterating this really harmful stereotype that like kind of came out of the book Love and Respect, which is horrible and like very inaccurate and uses a lot of like not great science essentially to try to say that men only want respect and women only want love, and that the way to have a good marriage is for women to respect your husbands and men to love your wives, because apparently we don't either. Like, I mean, one, it's a very, you know, heteronormative relationship to begin with, and so no other relationships exist, but also to say that this is exactly how men are and this is exactly how women are. But like the word respect tends to get thrown around in these like really conservative churches as a way to like denote a power differential, which is funny because it's something that they really deny a whole lot.
Right.
They don't want to say that there's, or they say that power differentials like don't exist, or that there's not, you know, a power difference between a pastor and the congregation, or even like a boss and an employee and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so we're just taught to respect anyone in any kind of power above you. So God, your pastor, for like women in the church, your husband. And then it gets thrown into like the complementarian view of marriage and relationships where like men and women are supposed to complement each other, but they aren't equal. And it turns into like one partner has to be respected, and that partner has been put in place by God, and you have to respect them because that's what's in the Bible, and the Bible is clear, which all the Bible is clear means is just my specific interpretation of the Bible is clear, and it's the only correct interpretation, and all others are heretical.
Yep.
Like that is all I hear when I hear someone say the Bible is so clear on this. It just means that they believe this one specific interpretation of a book that was not written in English and has been translated over and over and over again.
Yeah, the words these also are often not there. Like people don't actually look into what the words originally meant. They just roll with what they read.
There's like so many commentaries too, and it turns into the same thing of like, oh, this commentary is the only right one and all the other commentaries are not right. And they'll just kind of find the one that most fits their particular belief system in general. But as long as it's, you know, it mostly is fear-based.
Yeah.
And if you don't believe this exact interpretation of things, you're going to go to hell. And which is like the ultimate fear in general.
Yeah.
But it turns into like, if you don't respect your husband, then you're going to go to hell. Or if you don't, if you try to lead in any way in your relationship, like a lot of pastors will make jokes about like the women wearing the pants in the relationship and think that that's like against what God said, because apparently God himself wrote the entire Bible by hand in English. and it just gets thrown around that like the Bible is backing up all of these misogynistic beliefs that, again, like people don't see as abusive until they either get out of it or they have someone from outside tell them, hey, that's not okay. Like this is not, you know, the correct way to view women or people in general, and trying to back up your misogyny with the Bible is actually really harmful and probably not what Jesus would have wanted if that's the way you're like trying to live your life. But yeah, I keep seeing it on like Christian influencers' Instagrams and Mark Driscoll's Instagram, like all these pastors' Instagrams saying things that like the guy in Texas who just doubled down on his misogyny basically until somebody finally called him out enough times. And I think he realized he was about to launch a book and that probably his book sales would not do well if he didn't apologize.
Yeah,
but even then it was still like, oh, well this, I respect my wife so much, or I love my wife so much. And so that's why I talked about how I wasn't tempted by this like Jezebel. And it's like, well, you're still calling a woman a Jezebel.
Yeah.
So it's not great.
For existing. Yeah. For existing. And I think the thing, first of all, just took a peek at Mark Driscoll's Instagram. 0 out of 10. Pretty bad.
I took some fun screenshots of my favorite captions today. So
yeah, there was like one, I mean, in the 30 seconds I just spent scrolling, he covered how real men are being ruined by DoorDash, which obsessed with that narrative. That is fucking hilarious. Really just like that we're doing a sermon about that. I think that's really funny. And then he had another one about, of course, like he has a really gross obsession with being very pervy on stage.
Yes.
Like he is a little, that man is a pervert. And
he
so
really
he did
is.
Of course some like pleasure and sex one, because he loves Song of Songs and probably jerks off to it daily.
Just had that new book released with about sex again.
Yeah. Another sex book. Cause we all need more sex talk from Mark Driscoll.
From Mark Driscoll.
And then he did, of course, another like, fuck non-binary people, because that's, you know, he had to give his little 2 cents on that too. But yeah, I think that you made a really good point in terms of you don't realize it's it's odd or bad, or that mm-hmm. this isn't the way you should talk about people until someone else from the outside comes yeah. in and says, hey, this is not okay. And I think the thing that's so interesting is a lot of, I mean, obviously Christians react poorly to this, but a lot of people react poorly to like thinking of evangelical Christianity as a cult. Mm-hmm. However, when you get into like some of the nitty gritty of like what a cult is and mm-hmm. the cutoff from the outside world, and like it actually has a lot of similarities. And growing up, like I was not allowed to listen to secular music until I was almost 14. I had villains and things that did not align with the evangelical upbringing that I was being raised in, sharpied out of books. I had, couldn't eat Lucky Charms because they were lucky. Like it went deep.
That's my favorite one.
Oh yeah. That's my favorite one too. My mom also thinks that that was dumb. Like as an adult, like now she had us when she was like 30 and like 20 years later, she's like, yeah, that was stupid. Oh, like I will own that. That was dumb. And it's funny too, because I have a little sister who's 10 years younger than me. And so there's a gap where my parents have parented my 10-year-old sister so much differently.
Oh my gosh.
So funny because like she like started listening to Ariana Grande when she was like 9 and like loves her. Oh, and it's like my parents have totally shifted the way they parent because they realized it was like, we went way too hard in the paint.
It was
like, this was way too intense. But
it's
I think
a lot of work for them too.
I mean, imagine like every time you get your kid a book, you're sharpieing out the villains. That's a lot. But so it's just one of those things where there's those kind of little funny, goofy things that are seem kind of harmless. And then you get to a point where it's like, I only had Christian friends. I only consumed Christian media, and like I only listened to Christian radio stations. And then you get to a point where from a larger, broader, like ethical perspective, you're growing up in an environment where everyone is far too involved in your business. In all aspects, it's like random elders or mentors. First of all, the obsession with mentors in evangelical Christianity is very interesting. There's such an emphasis on like finding a mentor, which in my mind is kind of just a find an authority that is closer to you than closer to you in proximity than the pastor, because the pastor can't technically keep track of everybody's bullshit. And so it's like, get somebody else who can kind of like hold you accountable. And the accountability thing was very odd too. There's like such a, like, you got to have an accountability partner. And it wasn't just an accountability partner for like sex. Like I know like my girlfriends that I would call accountability partners as a teenager were also like, did you do your devotionals? Like, did you read the Bible?
That was the thing.
Did you pray? Like, and then it was also
your quiet time.
Yeah. And then it was also the like purity culture accountability of like, are you staying pure? Like, how are you doing with that? And I mean, it creates this environment where you have no privacy and everything is fair game to be questioned and held accountable for, like, quote unquote. And I think there's so much control. There's so much input. Too many people are having input in your life. Like, there are so many people having input on what you should do, what you should wear, who you should be with, if you should do this with your body, if you shouldn't. And that does extend into adulthood. And I think the thing that's so bizarre is like, for me personally, I grew up in these environments and didn't escape from the environments until I was 22. So I was like, I had already lived like a quarter of my life basically in these environments. And so when I got out, it was like oh, that's weird. A lot of this is weird. Like, normally you don't have people checking in on your sex life when you are a full ass adult. Like, that is weird. Yeah. And we can get into kind of the purity culture leading to abuse part, but I'll give a tiny bit of context on my background, which is why I wanted to talk about this, honestly, is I was talking with my therapist recently about the fact that when I was starting to transition out of Christianity a little bit, I was questioning, I was going through some shit. It started to not make as much sense to me. I had a problem with the ethics. I was in college and I had grown up in such a restrictive environment that college was really bizarre to me, even though it was a Christian college, which for context, my Christian college had input on can't drink, can't have sex, If you do have sex, you have to tell us and like give us details, and like we mm-hmm. are going to like give you a consequence, which even that, when you yeah. just take that from an objective perspective, you're giving consequences to adults who are not doing anything mm-hmm. illegal.
That's
yeah. weird. We weren't allowed to have our doors shut because we couldn't have a guy in our room with our door shut. So even if you yep. were dating someone Same. And just wanted to have a time to chat with your partner, you couldn't do that mm-hmm. privately. And all of that was so comfy, warm, normal for me because mm-hmm. I came from an environment growing up where that was the reality. I did the purity yeah. contract. I did the check-ins with my parents. And so then yeah. I went to this school, and every other person I've met as an adult who did not go to a private Christian college is absolutely in shock about the stories yep. that I've told them. Even my partner, who grew up Mormon and went to BYU, which is still relatively restrictive, but wow. he was like amazed at the shit that happened at my Christian college. He was yep. like, what the fuck is going on? Like, that is crazy.
It's another world.
It's wild. And so the whole reason I'm talking about this is it didn't set mm-hmm. off red flags for me. Yeah. None of it was frightening. Exactly. None of it was like, hey, this is not appropriate. This is controlling. This is abusive.
Yeah.
It was just like, ooh, comfy, warm. This is home. Like mm-hmm. I'm used to this.
Yeah.
And so what happened is I started to have little bits of freedom. Because naturally, mm-hmm. if you're out of your parents' household, you will have freedom you didn't have previously. And yeah. my college did their best to try to restrict that freedom as best mm-hmm. as they could. But Same. I ended up dating someone who was very controlling, very mm-hmm. restrictive, because I think in my mind, I was just like craving authority because I was so someone used to it.
Yeah.
I was a relatively like fiery, independent person, but I was just mm-hmm. so used to having someone have input that when I got into an abusive relationship where I had a partner mm-hmm. telling me I couldn't watch the Kardashians and I wasn't allowed to have fake nails and I wasn't allowed to dye my hair a certain color, and he didn't want me to wear this specific pair of pants because he thought they made him look stupid, and I wasn't allowed to eat certain foods. And when I decided I didn't want to eat a certain food, he held me down and threw the food like away and was screaming at me. None of that set off red flags.
Yeah. Well, you're also, when you're told they're supposed to be the leader in the relationship, that's what you go
mm-hmm.
with.
And so it didn't set off red flags. And that's, mm-hmm. that creates environments that are so hospitable for abuse and sexual assault and domestic violence. Mm-hmm. Like there is just so much that can happen there because mm-hmm. you have not been taught how to have autonomy in a relationship, what consent looks like, what healthy communication looks like, what equity looks like in a partnership. None of that mm-hmm. has been taught. And so when there isn't equity, it's not a red flag. It's just familiar. Yeah. And I've seen it happen with so many girls, even in my friend group mm-hmm. that like grew up in the same church as me and then found these guys who would just boss them around and like tell mm-hmm. them what to do. And like, I had one friend that like her partner came over and was like telling her where she should put things in her house that she had just gotten, and they did not live together. And it was like,
oh my God,
it was just like, what is going on? Like, why are like, and it really was like scratched my brain. And I had a conversation with her about like, I think that you ditched Jesus and you found a new Jesus. Like you found someone else to fill that Jesus shaped hole in your heart but not in like a, oh, I'm so sad, but in like, I need someone to tell me what to do. I need authority. Yeah. I need these parameters, because you're thrown into an environment where you're so used to parameters
mm-hmm.
that not having any is terrifying and like really frightening and feels really off, which obviously can lead to some really dangerous situations.
Yeah. It's been interesting too, to see like the, I don't know, ex-evangelical, like people, especially more on Twitter than Instagram, talk about like almost defend in some cases that kind of dynamic and say like, yes, I left the church, or yes, I got out of the conservative church and I'm you know, fully affirming now. And I, you know, believe that women have rights and all this kind of stuff. But I still think that a man should be the head of a relationship, or which immediately upon saying that means that you're probably not that affirming. If you believe that a man should be the head in a relationship, it just means that you're saying like all relationships should be heteronormative anyways.
Right.
But also to have people like defend it so hard and just say, this is the way that Like, even if they don't say that God intended it, they'll say, this is the way that, like, men and women were made differently. Mm-hmm. And we, this is just what we have to, you know, deal with, basically. And it's been very, like, both interesting and sad to see people try to, like, I don't even want to say educate, because it's not really educating, but almost just push back just a little bit on people and say, hey, do you see how this could be, you know, just basically like a remnant of what you grew up with, and maybe there's a different way, and look at, you know, these other healthier relationships where, like, you know, my partner and I are equal and we are partners, and not one is not, you know, making all the decisions or whatever. And we might do different things, you know, chore wise, but that doesn't mean that that's how God made us or whatever. Right. And it's like this weird, like, one thing that a lot of people tend to still hold on to for some reason is the complementarian thing. That just ultimately, like you said, like, ends up leading, unfortunately, to abusive relationships where people want to, like, replace Jesus or some kind of pastoral figure with a partner that still is, you know, in charge of them, basically. Yeah. Which is wild to, and sad to watch too.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. And it's kind of what you said about the, there not being, like, any privacy, or, like, there's just a huge, like, lack of boundaries. It's mm-hmm. at the same time, it's like a lot of these people feel the need to explain themselves on Twitter and on Instagram, but mostly Twitter, because there's no boundaries. And there's a feeling of, like, I have to be honest about this. I have to open up, because that's what you're taught your whole life, is that if you're keeping secrets, I mean, that's mm-hmm. like what it was taught to me, was that if I was holding anything into myself, that it must be bad and it must be sinful. Mm-hmm. And so you're supposed to bring all of your struggles to light. You can't keep anything in the dark. You're supposed to be open and honest about, you know, anything that you're struggling with to your small group and your accountability partners and your, like, your husband or wife or whoever it is, because otherwise you're being somehow sinful by, like, hiding things.
Yeah.
And in reality, it took, you know, my therapist being like, you don't have to tell everyone everything. Like, that's not healthy either. Mm-hmm. Like, not everybody needs to have input on your life choices. And unfortunately, with social media, there's a lot more people that can have input on your
yeah.
life choices. And that can be, like, just crippling for so many people to not even know how to deal with, like, putting their entire life out publicly and then having people either criticize or kind of, like, defend them and say, yes, I want my relationship to be like this or whatever, but also criticize them and say, hey, have you thought maybe this isn't, like, the healthiest way? People have no idea how to deal with that. It reminds me, there's this Christian YouTube couple that I may have talked about in the last video, podcast.
I don't think
Paul and Morgan.
No.
Paul and Morgan are an interesting couple. They are, I'm so sorry for the deep dive that I'm about to send you on.
No, please do.
Fundy Fridays has done two really good videos about them, just their entire background. But they are a married couple. They have, like, a small son. But they are notorious for giving way too much information on YouTube. And they just recently did a video that was like a, I think they called it, like, agree to disagree. And so they had this paper, like, lined up that had, like, a scale from, like, strongly agree to strongly disagree. And they would, like, say a statement, and then they'd have to, like, put their cup or whatever, whether they agreed or disagreed and where on that scale, and then talk about it. And so some of the stuff was things that they hadn't talked about. And one of the statements that for some reason was in this weird game that they played was, I've thought about divorce. And Paul said he agreed, and Morgan said she disagreed. And that was the first time that she had heard that. And they decided to not only leave that in the video and post it publicly, she cries. It's, like, heartbreaking to watch. And, like, they have a lot of, like, issues individually and whatever, but, like, it was heartbreaking to watch that, like, this girl be told that the first few years of their marriage that were really hard, he had contemplated divorce but didn't ultimately go through with it because divorce is a sin and can't do that. And so to, like, have her, like, to watch her, like, have to process this in real time when she clearly had never heard this before, and then still post it online for like the world to see. And most of the comments underneath the video, even from some of their hardcore followers, are like, hey, some conversations probably should be private. Like, you didn't have to post this one. And they're notorious. Morgan did a video where she's crying for 12 minutes and it's heartbreaking to watch about how she's very lonely as a new mom and has a newborn and just, but it's her convincing herself that like, God has a plan for this. And it's a lot of like spiritual bypassing and all this kind of stuff. But it's the same thing of like, some of the stuff doesn't have to be public. And just because you are experiencing this or going through something doesn't mean that the entire world needs to know, or doesn't mean that your entire church needs to know, because sometimes people aren't safe people and everybody is not trustworthy. And it's so dangerous to grow up in a situation where you're taught your entire life that everybody is trustworthy if they're in the church. And so you trust everybody and you don't see any red flags when red flags come up, and you don't see anything that could possibly be wrong when either like an authority figure is abusive towards you or making comments about your body or like just being overtly like actually abusive towards you. You don't realize that that is abuse because you've just been taught your whole life that everybody has to know everything and that everybody in the church is trustworthy. And so why would I not trust somebody in the church? And also combine that with never learning about consent, like you said, mm-hmm. and having to sign a purity contract at the age of 12 when you're barely going through puberty, and being told that you'll disappoint your parents and your church leaders and God if you wear a low cut top when you're trying to figure out what to do with your body. And thinking about every single crush you have, could you marry them when you're 12?
Like, yeah, that's a big one. I did Mrs. whatever the person's last name was from a very young age in a really aggressive way. Like, I had a whole binder planning my wedding when I was 10, because there's much emphasis on marriage that I was like, I'm going to be a wife. And I was just like, and like literally had like printouts of all the dresses I was going to wear like calla lily bouquet ideas and I was literally nine or 10 and had a full binder and like thought, and there's a difference between like kiddos daydreaming and like having an obsession over the idea of marriage, because it's just chucked down your fucking throat as a kid.
All the time. And you're taught when you're finally like old enough to date or whatever, that you have to date for marriage, and that you mm-hmm. have to, every person, if you go on a few dates with them, it must mean because that's the person that God had for you, and you have to marry them now, and you have to marry them to have sex. And so like when you're taught all of that from such a young age, and that's your framework for the world. And like you said, like I was the same way. I grew up in a Christian school. I went to public school for just high school. And that was such a culture shock that I went back to a Christian private college. And it was still kind of like I was trying to like find, you know, my own little ways to like have freedom within that, but it was still very restrictive. Mm-hmm. But you're also taught in all of those environments to repress all of your feelings, to repress like any sexual feelings. And so when that's combined with not knowing, having no sexual education and not knowing about consent, it's like the perfect, you know, recipe for an abusive relationship and the perfect recipe for someone to take advantage of you. And you have no idea. Like, that was my story. I didn't know that somebody was taking advantage of me. And I didn't know that just because it wasn't the, you know, like legal definition of rape that I was taught, that it mm-hmm. wasn't still abusive. And like, because I wasn't taught it in school, or like I wasn't taught any of that. And so I thought that when I said no and he would just like change his tactics or something, like I didn't realize that that was just coercion. And those were all ways to continue controlling me. And I had no idea, because no one had ever told me like, hey, someone's not supposed to treat you like that, or they're not supposed to like tell you the things that they're telling you in order to keep you with them. Like, that's not okay at all. And also, this is not my husband. He was a very different person.
No, totally fair. Yeah. So a few things. I think the coercion is a really good thing to bring up, because I've noticed mm-hmm. a lot of women that grow up in Christian mm-hmm. environments end up in coercive, abusive mm-hmm. relationships, and not always super blatantly obvious abusive relationships. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily the pipeline of like religion to now I'm getting punched in the face, because sometimes that's not
the only abuse. Yeah, that's the only abuse I was ever taught in church was physical abuse. There was no other kind of abuse.
Yep. And my rape, I've been raped twice, both of which were coercive environments from different people. And the latter, so I once when I was 15, once when I was 18, which the listeners of Mindful Minds have heard all the my story on this, but basically, like a lot of the manipulation tactics that were used when I was 18 was someone that I met at mm-hmm. the Christian college, worship leader, pastor's mm-hmm. kid, like very like, you know, typical Christian boy.
Yeah.
He was like a sex positive Christian boy, which actually is interesting with who you just brought up. I just looked up their account, like Paul and Morgan, because they talk about sex a lot. And she has like mm-hmm. a whole highlight on her Instagram called mm-hmm. Sexy Time Chats, where she talks about sex and talks about even like going and learning how to strip and do pole dances for her husband.
Oh, a recent one.
Yep. Yes. But how that is like
with Bethany okay. from Girl Defined.
Oh God. Yeah. But how that's okay because it's in the context of marriage. And so it's kind of this, it's very much so the purity culture 2.0 thing where it's like, now we're going to talk about sex and we're going to make it sound very enticing and fun, but only mm-hmm. in the context of marriage, even though the mechanics of it, like having sex mm-hmm. in a marriage and outside of a marriage, are pretty much the same when it comes to the mechanics, as long as you're in a safe environment. But like they make it seem like if you have it outside of marriage, it'll fucking ruin your life and you will have so much emotional damage. But if you have it inside of marriage, you can take a fucking pole dancing class and you can strip for your husband in your bedroom and you're going to have lots of fun. You can be kinky as hell and it's great.
Yeah.
But if you do it when you're not married, you will be depressed for the rest of your life and it will ruin you.
Even the night before marriage.
Oh yeah. Nope. You will fall into a deep, deep, deep depression. Yes. So it's very odd, but that was very similar to the way that my abuser framed sex was I really, truly wish I could think of what it was, because it was one of those things that in the moment I didn't like catalog in my brain as like, oh, this is important information. But he mm-hmm. brought out this like article about the needs in a marriage and in a relationship.
I was just about to talk about that. Yes. Yep.
And about like how you can have like needs and like how you can have this and how like for him as a man, he had really mm-hmm. high sexual needs.
That's not
And we had a whole conversation about like the fact that he had these really intense sexual needs and that I kind of needed to be okay with that. And mm-hmm. that he was, and it was all a setup for like, he wanted to have sex outside of marriage. I had set the boundary that I wasn't comfortable with that because I grew mm-hmm. up in purity culture and didn't want to fucking be depressed for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And go straight to hell.
Yeah. And go straight to hell. Super, super anxious. And so it was this thing where like, and I had grown up too in a purity culture environment where like my parents both, came to the Lord in their 30s mm-hmm. and had a whole life.
Did we have the same parents?
Maybe.
Should we have the same like growing up situation?
Our backgrounds are freakish. And so they came to the Lord at 30, had their lives, were born again virgins, mm-hmm. didn't kiss until the altar, which was like big deal.
That's an experience.
And that's what I grew up as my model for marriage. And so when I had my first
kiss. And you're taught. Oh, that's so romantic.
Yes. Oh my God. And so when it was my dream. It was my dream to like have my first kiss at the altar when I'm getting married. And so when I was 12,
we were precious.
When I was 12, I had my first kiss in a pastor's backyard at a church event, and we played Spin the Bottle because this is so stupid. They had a church event for children. 12-year-old children, it was like a camp out sleepover, but we had it in the pastor's backyard, which first of all is inappropriate. And they had the boys' tents and the girls' tents right next to each other with no adult supervision. And we all woke up in the middle of the night and were like lied, said that we were sleeping and like stayed up. And I kissed three boys in one night and I came home and sobbed. And
I was like, hussy. I'm a Jezebel.
And so that was the environment I grew up in. And so when my assaulter and I, we dated, we were in a relationship. Mm-hmm. It was not a random, I get knocked out over the head and get raped on the side of the road. This was a someone
that that's what you're taught too.
That's what you're taught.
That's all you're taught.
This was a pastor's kid, a worship leader who was going to a Christian college who I dated and framed sex as this, well, this is my need. And even got to the point where when I would say no, he would say, there was one specific narrative that he would always go back to about, like, I really think that the church like brainwashed you about how you view sex, and like tried to like almost be like purity culture is wrong, but use it as a way to like get to me. Find out later in my life that he's a serial assaulter and has assaulted like upwards of 5 girls, I think, at this point. And, it was this whole thing. I found that out by meeting another girl that he had raped, and we connected and realized we had the same rapist and like talked and figured it out. And, he had this habit of using the narrative of God to get sex out of people, where it was either the church brainwashed you, or it was, this is a godly need, or it was, us having sex is going to heal your sexual trauma. Like, it was all these random things that he had figured out. I ended up reporting it to my Christian college, went through an entire investigation that was based in purity culture, where in the middle of the investigation, I had sent him a partial nude, which was my first time ever sending a photo like that. And it was because he like kind of egged me on about it. And I'm not a nudes person. I don't know. Honestly, I have an eating disorder. I'm way too fucking insecure about my body. So I had sent this like kind of like half nudie thing. It was like, it was literally my ass cheeks, like in a, like a little one piece with a thong. Like,
it wasn't
like,
even boobs.
No, it was my fucking ass. And I had sent it to him, and in the investigation, I shit you not, this photo gets printed out and sat on the table as like a, well, Fina, if he raped you, why did you send him this? That was straight up the narrative.
A picture of your butt. Printed out
photo of my ass in front of multiple adults who worked at my school.
Oh my God.
But yeah, they had blurred it out, which is like,
that's incredible. Someone had to go through and like,
I know. Like blur. And it was all like, and I remember feeling so shameful and so embarrassed.
Yeah.
And so like, horrified. And it like, I came home and was sobbing and felt like, oh, I don't have the right to report my assault anymore. Like, they're right. Asked for this. I felt so awful. And thank God I had people in my life that like were honestly still very, they were still wrapped up in the purity culture shit, but they like had enough of arm's length away from it that they were able to like to talk me down. And so it was one of those things where, to your other point of the sharing too much information, I came to this investigation and just unloaded like everything as if I was in an accountability partner session of like, I'm so sorry, I fucked up. And then later in my life, even after I'd left Christianity, I started the podcast. And the first few podcast episodes, if you go back and listen to those episodes, I shared like way more than I share now about my personal life.
Yeah.
Because I just was, it was very similar in nature of you're giving someone a mic and saying like, talk about your trauma. And it was very similar to like getting up in it for an offering call or in the middle of a worship session and just like telling way too much testimony about my life. And so I just like, I remember like and it was a very small podcast to start off with. It was just my friends who already knew my life. So it didn't feel scary. And then I remember I started to do some education on my sexual assault story and learning about consent, and then learning about the fact that not everyone has a right to your story.
Yeah.
And the fact that if you just throw your heart and soul out to the world, not everyone is trustworthy, and you can get people who end up really harming you and hurting you and saying awful things because they just don't deserve your story, and you don't have to tell them. And it's become something where with my TikTok, I often only post very surface level shit, and it's all, I get the same bullshit responses from Christians of like, you picked the wrong church, you weren't a real Christian. You're mad at the church, not at God. And then some people just come straight out and call me an asshole, which I think is, I'm like, cool. Thanks for coming to the point. Super. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate your honesty.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And I just delete and block. And I'm just used to just deleting, blocking. I probably have upwards of like 1,000 to 2,000 people blocked on my TikTok because if literally you get blocked instantly.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of that TikTok, I would engage with people and I would like go back and forth about like, but I didn't pick the wrong church. I got abused in all the churches. It wasn't my fault. And I started to just realize the amount of emotional energy because I'd been brought up in an environment where you just talk about everything. There's nothing that's private. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that's yours. Anyone who critiques privacy you have to go back. Right.
Yeah.
And it's even to the point where if you go deeper into that and the secret thing, there are literal statistics showing that like the secrecy narrative leads to child abuse because kiddos get abused and don't realize that they can tell you. And it's to the point where moms nowadays that are smart and have done consent education. I was a nanny for 8 years. I had a lot of families that told me, please don't ever say to our kid, hey, can I tell you a secret? We don't do secrets. We do not do secrets in our house. We do. You can have private information that's just for you, but they always made it really clear that there was
not a secret between me and you.
Right. And I think the thing that's a hiccup with the kind of no secrets thing in Christianity is there's no secrets unless it's shameful. And then you kind of have no other option but to keep it a secret because the shame is so intense. And so it masks, it adds this environment of like, well, we're safe. You can talk to us. Unless you're gay or a whore or have seduced someone or, you know, want to kill yourself. Because a lot of times the suicide narrative also got sent into the sin category.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, now if you come to us, you're going to be shamed and you're going to be given a consequence or whatever. Yeah. And so it was this, it wasn't an actual, because I'm all for the environment of like with kiddos, like teaching them that, hey, here are safe secrets. Here are secrets that aren't safe. And like, here are things you can keep to yourself. And here are things that you do need to tell mom so that I can keep you safe. And I'm all for that. I think it's a great way to protect kiddos from potential abuse. But in the church, that wasn't the narrative. It wasn't an actual safe space. It was a, how can we keep tabs on you to make sure that you're doing what we want you to do? And then if we find out that you're not, how can we shame you to the high heavens so that you feel like shit and never fuck up again?
Yeah.
Like that was the reality. And
it almost gets you a like higher place within the church or within your church environment, the more open that you are. And there's such a weird, like, I don't know if it was the same way at your church. And I feel like it's just kind of a, it was just like a evangelical church thing of like, there was always such an emphasis on like, you had to have a really good testimony and had to talk about, you had to talk about all the hard things. And if you just had like a normal life, then it wasn't a good testimony. And the best testimonies were the ones that were like, I had an addiction problem. And also I had sex once and then I found Jesus. And like, those were the ones that like changed. Oh,
after I
lives.
Got raped, I was like, dude, my testimony rocks now. Are you kidding me? I get to go up there and be like, I got raped and I still love Jesus. Like, fuck all you guys. I look great. Yeah. And I got so much more stage time, by the way. I got invited to come up on the stage so much more often because I had like a dark testimony that was sad and was like aggressive. Yeah. And then I was like, but Jesus brought me through it. And in one of my testimonies, I have it on video, which is horrific, where I literally said, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, but at the very end, I said, like, I was towards the end of my started to deconstruct right before I deconverted and had said, like, I got up and shared my testimony and it was literally just me sharing therapy tools about rape.
Incredible.
Because I just was like, well, I'm not going to say that I prayed and that's how I fixed it. Like, that's not how I fixed it. I fixed it through therapy. Yeah. So I was sharing all these therapy tools at the very end of the testimony. I was like, and honestly, like if I had to go through it again, I would, because it brought me so much closer to Jesus. And then I listened to it again years later. And I was like, oh, like Fina, like, no, you don't wish you would have been raped again so you could get closer to Jesus. Like, do you realize how insane that sounds? But I really felt like I had some extra like badges on my sash because I went through some hard shit and I came back to Jesus.
Yeah.
Which is insane.
Oh my God. That's wild. Yeah. I have definitely, I was a chronic oversharer for years until the past few years of like being in therapy and having my therapist be like, hey, you don't have to tell everybody everything. Like you can keep some things to yourself, or you can process things just by yourself. Like, yeah. or you can tell someone, like you can process some things out loud with people who are safe people, but you don't have to process all those things out loud and let them in on your process while you're going through it. If they're not a safe person, you can just tell them kind of where you ended up.
Yep.
And so it, and there's a weird like push to like by churches, I guess, or by like church leaders and stuff to like push people into telling their stories too, and push them into not keeping secrets and being, you know, having accountability and all this kind of stuff that turns into abusive friendships. It turns into like abusive relationships at all levels, like
yep.
abusive friendships, abusive relationships with just within the church hierarchy, kind of abusive marriages, like abusive parenting. Like it just kind of goes all the way down the line from being told yeah, that like you're like not allowed cancer. To have any secrets. Yeah. And you're not allowed to keep anything to yourself, because that's obviously, if you were keeping it to yourself, it must be sinful, mm-hmm. or it must be something that, you know, you don't want even like anyone to know or something, which is just ridiculous. Like, I'm thank God for therapists, but
yeah, no kidding. Well, and it also breeds, like, in my personal opinion, and this is also just from personal experience, but the reason why I got in contact and started to date my rapist was because I had told him that I had been raped before. And I overshared to him about an experience that he did not have the right to know about yet. I did not know him well yeah. enough for him to know that information. But it was classic, like first few weeks of a Christian college, you're in that like campfire coffee house environment mm-hmm. where you're like, let's all talk about our testimonies. And I started talking yes. about it to him, find out later that he's a serial rapist and specifically picks girls who have been raped prior. Like that's it's like wild. Intentional, like crazy like
a monster.
Yes. And yeah. so like it also creates environments where you put yourself in honestly like unsafe situations, because you're telling people mm-hmm. things about yourself that they might not have the right to know. And that can actually make you more susceptible to abuse, because not yeah. everyone, you assume people are like, you know, like you said, trustworthy if they're in a mm-hmm. religious environment, when in reality, a lot of religious people, as we've seen over the past few years of all the scandals and shit, have really long, manipulative, coercive histories of abuse. And so
yeah.
sometimes sharing information with people can be used as ammo against you, where it can literally
yeah.
put you in a situation where then you are abused because of the information that you shared. And
yeah.
as a person who, like, I took a lot of that guilt and put it on myself mm-hmm. for a long time of like, mm-hmm. well, I should have just never told him. And it took a long time to unpack the fact that like, no, I was raised in an environment where nothing was sacred. Nothing was mine. My body wasn't yeah. mine. My thoughts weren't mine. My, mm-hmm. my questions weren't mine. My experiences weren't mine. My trauma wasn't mine. Everything had to mm-hmm. be public, shared. Everyone had to have their input on it. Nothing was actually mm-hmm. mine. And so
yeah.
it took a long time to be able to like get to a point where things could feel like they belonged to me, to the point where I literally got yeah. tattooed on my arm. I belong deeply to myself, because I was like, it took so long for me to be like,
yeah,
okay, I am my own. I don't have to tell things to people. I don't have to share everything yeah. with everyone. And it really does breed abuse. And like, I'm not just saying yeah. that like lightly, but like as someone who has like very much so experienced it, like mm-hmm. it can really create environments. And yeah, same thing with friends, same thing with even like, you could be susceptible to like going to other cults. Like it's even things like that yeah. where it's like, you've just been raised in environments where there's always restriction. And so it's not yeah. surprising if you then seek out more restriction,
yeah.
eating disorders. We could mm-hmm. the whole other aspect there where it's all restriction, yeah. restriction, restriction, and people having input on things. The church yeah, often on your has body inputs. From yep your body's a temple uh-huh. like only yeah. having skinny girls as worship leaders, like all of that yeah. it really it's very all-encompassing in terms of everyone has opinion on everything, and you don't mm-hmm. have a space to ever be your own and make your own decisions yeah. and it sets you up for adulthood in a really, really poor way.
Yeah, I mean, there's been multiple studies like recently done that I think are, I know at least one of them is linked in my Instagram bio, that show that there's a link between like what the researchers called like restrictive sexual values and harmful sexual assault narratives that mostly like victim blame just in general. And it's not just within the church, but they did find that like the majority of people who were represented in the studies were learned those values through a church environment and learned that they either didn't have any privacy or had to, their body belonged to someone else, or that they, it was their fault for some reason, but they, it also led to, like, you know, just constant issues with like marital rape. Like that's something that was never taught in the church and still is not taught in many, especially conservative churches, something that purity culture influencers now just refuse to admit that it exists. And because we're taught that when we get married in our, you know, obviously monogamous heterosexual marriages, that sex is a right and that your body belongs to your spouse. And there's so many Christian sex and marriage books about your body belonging to your spouse. And when you're taught that from a really young age, and you're also taught to, you know, control your body, and you're taught your body belongs to God and not yourself, and then you're taught that it also belongs to your spouse and still not yourself, then if you were raised as a woman in the church, you were taught to not deprive your husband of sexual needs and taught the same bullshit that is not scientific at all, that somehow men need sex all the time and women don't, and you just have to like put up with it. And there's been, you know, the good old Paula Morgan. God, I hope they don't hear this, because they have a tendency to like go after people. I think I blocked them already, but they they just go after people on their YouTube channel. But they have gotten so much pushback, like in the past year or so, for constantly saying that if you're in a fight with your spouse and you're mad with them, because obviously sex is only happening in marriage. So if you're in a fight with your spouse, you still should have sex with them. If you were planning to have sex because they have a sex calendar. So like, so if you were mad at them,
why is that so common in evangelical couples? Because like evangelical couple I've ever met has a sex calendar.
Because most of them are taught that like women are never going to ask for sex. And so have to plan it.
Women are never horny.
Never, not once. And you have to plan it so that you make sure that it still happens so that your husband doesn't leave you. Because if you don't have sex with him, someone else will, and it will be your fault because you were depriving him of sex. And it's like
lovely
and intentionally, because you were intentionally depriving him. Like they always try to give that caveat of like, sometimes things just happen. Like you are pregnant or just had a baby or you're
and
sick
the doctor
and you
literally
can't have
is
sex.
Telling you that you cannot said, have sex.
Yeah.
Bust your pussy open. Like, yeah. Like, that's a valid reason to not want to have sex.
Yeah.
God, that's so stupid.
But yeah, you're taught that like, if you're intentionally depriving your husband of sex, that it's sinful. And then there's still like, you know, every person has a different like level of libido. And mm-hmm. and that's just something that you work through on, you know, with yourself. And yeah. So it's not a male versus woman thing. It's not a testosterone versus like estrogen thing. It's just people are different. Like, yeah. And that's all it is. And even under like a lot of these, you know, purity culture influencers videos and stuff and Instagram posts, there's always at least one person that's like a woman who says, I have a way higher sex drive than my partner. Like, what do I do?
Yeah.
And they're always just like, that's great. So you're getting sex all the time. It's like, no, I'm the one that has the higher sex drive. I can't like force him into sex. Cause that like, what do I do? And they just never really have much of an answer for that other than men just go have sex with your wives and it's great and fun. And
right.
Like,
cause the male sexual needs are prioritized. It's they're the priority is
yeah.
They're getting what they want.
Yeah.
It's not the other way around.
And yeah, exactly. And I mean, they're not going to admit that like women's pleasure exists to begin with.
Right.
So,
well, and the thing that's so crazy too, like, cause I really actually just now am realizing how often I was very hesitant to say no to sex, even
yeah.
if in a like, oh, I haven't had sex with this person in a while, I probably should. And
yeah.
In my current relationship, that's never been a thing ever. ever. Yeah. And it's always just been very like safe. But in the abusive relationship that I was in, who was not my rapist, like that was not the same relationship. There was a constant narrative of, oh, well, I just did this for you, so you mm-hmm. owe me. Or, yeah, oh, well, I did this for you three times last week, so you owe me this many. And yeah. I would feel really anxious and uncomfortable ever saying, mm-hmm. well, I just don't really want to right now. And I remember like mm-hmm. the first time having a safe relationship and saying, oh, I'm just not really in the mood right now, and feeling like yeah. bracing myself to be yes. screamed at and yeah. not receiving that reaction and being like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, I can't say no, which was very healing yeah. from coming from an environment where I had been sexually assaulted, where it was like, oh, I am yeah. allowed to say no. And last night I asked my partner, hey, if our relationship never had sex in it ever for the rest mm-hmm. of our lives, where there was no sex yeah. involved ever, like, would you still want to be with me? And he was like, yeah, what the fuck? And then like kept making dinner.
Just, yeah. It's like,
what kind of question is that? And I was like, okay, like,
okay, thanks.
Just had some insecurity, had to get it out.
Yeah.
Like, sorry. And it was just like the fact that I really truly think that's so often, I think it's a world thing, to be totally honest. I think it's just the fact yeah. that the world is often incredibly patriarchal, but it's really yeah. emphasized in religious environments. And I mean, Mark Driscoll is like a
morality attached to it.
Yeah. And Mark Driscoll is a huge part of that. I mean, even mm-hmm. the classic fucking sex home thing, which just God. Really is truly favorite thing he's ever said, because I think I think from a
impact penis of, home. We were penis homes. Home.
Thank you. Yes, penis home.
Yes.
I
sex
think
home would be less insane.
Yes. I think that it's horrible, but also I've told my partner as like a joke, I'm like, yeah, I'm just a penis home. Like that's all I am. Home. It's fine. I think that like it's so outlandish and it's funny to laugh at when I'm yeah. out of it. But like, I remember yeah. like my family was never Mark Driscoll sympathizers. My dad actually yeah. has recently dived into the Mark Driscoll podcast thing about where they unpacked all of his bullshit of the Mars Hill podcast.
Oh, yes.
And my dad is like so in it. And it's just like, Mark Driscoll's a trash bag. Like my dad just like hates
he is,
him
now. That he is. Perfect.
But yeah, welcome. Which like, go dad.
yeah.
But it's funny because like we were never – you hear that, and for the environment I grew up in, hearing the penis home mm-hmm. thing felt crazy. That wasn't like a, I yeah. heard that and thought, oh yeah, we're penis homes. No, I heard that and was like, yeah. oh, like gross.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is the environment I grew up in and the church I grew up in echoed all of those narratives and all of that.
Yeah.
That storyline of the fact that women are there to please men, but they just weren't yeah. as Mark Driscoll has just always been, yeah, he's just always been more explicit and more aggressive with the yeah. way he talks about it. But honestly, yeah. all of the churches have perpetuated that narrative.
They've gone that way now. Yeah. yeah.
Just not in the gross, direct yeah. way that Mark Driscoll has. So it's interesting yeah. because it really is a narrative that's a pretty common thread through evangelical churches just in general.
Yeah. When my husband and I were at a different church where we used to live, anytime there was like a marriage conference or like a marriage book study or whatever it was, like the emphasis every single time was always on sex. And it was like, we went to one like marriage conference, and it was thankfully it was in our city. So we didn't have to travel anywhere. And we like left after the first day and we're like, that was really stupid. Because the whole time, all they talked about was the difference between men and women and sex. And you have to have sex like this many times or this, like they would never like put a number on it, but they would be like, you have to have frequent sex in order to like make God happy, basically. And in order to have a healthy marriage. And if you're not having sex, you don't have a healthy marriage. And there was never any emphasis or any, like, it wasn't until I was like in therapy and, you know, reading marriage like books and stuff that weren't Christian that I learned that like marriage is never taught as being within the context of like a healthy, safe relationship with somebody that you trust and love, but also just a safe person where you feel the freedom to like consent or not consent. It's marriage in a lot of these churches, the way that it's taught still is based on sexual frequency that is like moralized and saying that it's your duty and obedience to have sex with your spouse, you know, at least once a week or three times a week or whatever. And when your entire worldview hinges on this idea that there's this like one specific interpretation of the Bible in English that says that this is your duty to God and your husband, like you will justify anything to stay in that worldview, to not have to question that and be like, oh, wait, maybe this is not a safe relationship, or maybe this person wouldn't stay with me if we didn't have sex. Like maybe this is not a healthy relationship, or maybe they're not a healthy, safe person.
Yeah.
Like you'll just justify anything you need to until you're, you know, I mean, ready to like face whatever you need to face, but to just stay within that like very, very specific worldview that ends up just perpetuating abuse over and over again. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of coming to the end of our time here, but I don't think we did this in the last episode, but I want to end with like a little bit of advice, I guess. If people are listening to this and are maybe kind of getting that like icky feeling in their stomach of like, oh God, like this is, I relate to a lot of this. This is like, I see this in my own relationship. Like getting that kind of like anxious feeling of, oh no, they might be talking about me. Do you have any advice of how to exit that, or how to process first steps to take to kind of educate themselves and start to exist in an environment that maybe isn't as authoritarian or isn't as restricting? Like what would your first steps be?
I mean, first recognize that you're not alone and that you're not the only person going through this, and that this is unfortunately really, really common and something that the system that you grew up in perpetuated and like wanted you to stay in. And that's the only thing that you knew, and you did the best you could with what you knew at the time. And that's okay. And like, that will take some level of grief to like work through and know that like, it's okay to grieve that and say that I wish I had a different, you know, growing up experience or a different view of the world because of this. But the next thing I would say is find a good therapist. I always recommend Reclamation Collective because they have a network of trauma-informed religious trauma, like repeating myself, religious trauma, like trauma-informed therapists in their little network. And so you can find somebody in your state. You can find some that practice, like just do telehealth, that are in multiple states. But just someone that will understand what you're talking about when you say these things and say like, this is some stuff that I grew up with, and not look at you like you're crazy, because sometimes therapists don't always, if they didn't grow up with it, they don't understand. But also someone that can validate you and give you like very practical steps to start working through some of those things. And also like find your safe people. If you have like one safe person in your life that you can tell this to, or tell that like, hey, I'm not sure that this is a safe relationship or something, like have those safe people if you need to make a plan to like exit that relationship.
Yeah. And I'll also link some resources, because I have some resources on my website about therapists and trauma stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'll link that collective as well, because that's fantastic to know. Mm-hmm. But I'd say too, like children's therapist worksheets are really helpful. That sounds kind of silly.
Yes, they are.
But like children's therapy worksheets are often, they just bring you to like the stuff you should have learned as a kid, honestly. Like it brings you to the stuff of like, you should have probably learned about boundaries and consent as a kiddo and you didn't. And so it can be really helpful to do like child's therapy worksheets. And so I always link therapistaid.com always. They're fantastic. Mm-hmm. And they have a worksheet that's like, where do I feel certain things in my body? I think they have a safety one where it's like a hand and it's the five people you feel safe, which can be helpful if you grew up in a like oversharing environment. It's like, what are the five people I feel like I can talk to? And maybe I don't share things with other people right now. Maybe I just share with these five people and kind of retrain my brain that not everyone needs to know everything. And they have my favorite one is the where do I feel things in my body, the body map, where you color the emotion and you color where you feel in your body. Because that was like the first step I took to trauma healing. But there's a lot of that. And then I've had so many people ask me on TikTok, social media, podcasts, emails, everything. Like, how did you heal? And to be totally honest, like my first step was just separating myself entirely from religion. But I know that's not everybody's first step, because some people are not looking to deconvert. They're just looking to deconstruct. For me, it started as deconstruction and then it ended as deconversion, where I entirely separated myself from religion. And a huge part of my environment was, it was just like, it was an infected group of people that everyone had this kind of like cancerous mindset. And there were such deep roots of misogyny and homophobia and racism and fatphobia and sexism and shame and like all these things that just went so, so deep that it was like, I kind of just felt like I can't heal if I stay in this like very sick environment. I'm not going to be able to actually heal. So for me, it was just leaving. Like I couldn't find any other route to healing than just exiting. But I know that I found actually more healing in environments that aren't just all about deconstruction, but that are about education, which is why I like your page so much, because your page is not just like a, like deconstruction can be hard. It's like here are all the reasons why like purity culture is harmful, and it's very intersectional. It's not just the like, how do we deconstruct? Because I found a lot of times that when I would seek healing in these deconstruction spaces, it would stay a lot of the times in the anger.
Yes.
And they were very angry and bitter.
Yeah.
And I had a time period where I was very angry and very bitter.
And that's healthy too.
And that's fine. Yeah. Yeah. And I just did a post on my page like last week about like, feel your anger. Like it does need to come out at some point. And if it doesn't come out, it'll come out in a way that it is very unpredictable. But I needed to feel the anger, but I felt that like a lot of the deconstruction spaces kept me in that angry space where it was like, it wasn't, there were no solutions. There were no like, here's how to,
there were no next steps.
No, it was just like, stay angry. And it was really hard for me, because it was like, I was so exhausted from being angry. I didn't have any energy to be angry anymore. And that was why I ended up just like, stop following all of them, was not even because I had a conscious awareness of like, hey, this might not be healthy. I literally just ran out of energy. I was like, I don't have the energy to be angry anymore. And like, viewing your posts is like exhausting. It's not like, it's not feeling fulfilling or like life-giving to me. It's literally feeling exhausting and I'm burnt out. But yeah, so I can link all the resources. A lot of them are just on my website too, because I will praise Therapist Aid to the rooftops. That's awesome. Like genuinely, I think Therapist Aid is fantastic.
I will also say too, like if you're like listening to this and you find yourself being like, I could never leave my church, like that's my entire community, or I will be so lonely, like it took me a long time to realize this. That's not a healthy environment. If you're saying that my entire community, I will lose everything if I leave this church, if they've cut you off from everything, or if they have said you know, even if they don't say it explicitly, if that's really become your entire life, then it's probably going to be healthier for you in the long run to separate yourself from them and know that like, you will find other people. Like there are other people out there, you know, through different, you know, the new evangelicals like Facebook group is helpful, especially if you're like just stepping into the deconstruction world or just stepping into like leaving a church. It's been really helpful to like find other people in various stages of like deconstruction and also deconversion and stuff. And then one thing that's like a very practical thing that my therapist and Meg Cowan, who I do a lot of stuff with, went through with me, was this idea of like, if you're a very visual learner, like I am, like putting yourself in like your own little bubble and then drawing bubbles like around you and kind of like, so there's like circles all the way, oh, I just hit my mic. So there's circles all the way around you and putting people kind of in those different circles. And so the people that are closest to you, like you can, if they're talking to you through your little bubble, like you can hear them and they can hear you. And so they're, you know, opinion matters and you want to keep them close to you. And as you kind of put people in other circles, if they're talking to you, like through all these different bubbles, it means what they're saying probably isn't important to your life. And it means like you can kind of filter them out. Like you can still talk back to them and tell them, I don't need this right now, or have like a casual relationship with them or whatever it is. But they don't get to, you know, speak into your life in any meaningful way because there's so many circles out. That was weirdly super helpful for me to like start almost categorizing people, which sounds like a really weird term, but just categorizing people
a little bit.
Yeah. And realizing like, okay, there are people who are not safe people in my life that I wouldn't, that like when they do either try to give me advice or speak into something, it's I don't feel better or like I don't feel seen or heard. And so they're probably right. going to be in like a different bubble or whatever. It was really helpful to just start that process of being like, oh, a lot of those people were from this part of my life or this church or whatever it was. Like it was a good, I don't know, visual like for me for to start that. I don't know if that helps anybody, but
yeah, no, I think I had someone tell me recently that like, if you don't want to be living that person's life, don't take advice from them. Like unless ooh, their life for you feels like almost like, cause there are people who I listen to and I'm like, oh, I'd really like to be more like this person. Like I really like the mm-hmm. way they are kind and the way that they speak. But if someone is giving mm-hmm. you advice and you're like, yeah, I don't want your life. It's like, why would you listen to that person yeah. giving you advice on your life? Like it doesn't really yeah. make any sense. Even if that is someone that is like previously an authority figure or a parent or a sibling yeah. or a pastor, like if you look at their life mm-hmm. and say, that's not the life I want, that's probably not the person yeah. you're taking advice from.
Yeah.
Which for me was like, slap me in the face. I was like, whoa, that's like, I've never thought about it that way. And it was a big thing for me with social media because it was like, I would have people yes. comment on my shit and it was like, I don't know you. I don't want your life. I don't give a shit yeah. what you say. Like, it does not matter to me.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of TikTok specifically, I took everything so personally and people would be so mean. Yeah. And I remember I just was telling my sister about this. I did my first live on TikTok, like probably like a year ago. And, everyone was like, it was not my followers, it was random people. And people were so mean and were just like, oh, this ugly bitch wants to talk. And like, oh, she looks like Edna Mode. And I just, geez. I literally like broke into tears after. I was so upset.
Oh,
and I remember like awful. I think it was a friend was just like, they're, you don't know them. Like who cares? Yeah. It doesn't matter. And also maybe don't go live again. Don't give people access yeah. to your life so they can just tear you down. Maybe that's not the way that you reach people. Like maybe that's not your method of communication. Cause obviously
yeah, exactly.
you're sharing things and it's not being received well and people are being very yeah. evil and cruel. And so it was kind of yeah. one of those things where it was like, okay, like I don't need to put myself in a position to be harmed. I can yeah. stay, keep something to myself, which once again is always a learning yeah. curve for me. I am also a chronic oversharer. And so yeah. like it really is always a learning curve for me to like correct myself and be like, maybe I don't need to share that. But
yeah,
yeah I would just say just if you don't want to live that person's life, maybe don't take their advice.
Yeah.
And if you do,
yeah.
then
and
like,
if you yeah. don't, yeah, if you don't, if you have to hide parts of yourself and not in terms of like keeping secrets or whatever, like, but if you have to hide like the person that you are or like the things that you like and don't like or parts of your personality, then that's not going to be a safe person to like let them into your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And
took
I
me
would
too
I
long
would,
to realize that.
Yep. Yep. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on again. You're literally always welcome back at any point. Cause I feel like we could unpack any aspect of any of this and go for an hour. Yeah. Doesn't even matter what the topic is. But I want to give people a chance to find you so they can look at your content. Cause like I said, I love your thanks. Stuff and I have to actually thank really you. Restrict myself to not repost too many of your things. Cause it just looks ridiculous. Cause my entire story will be like, and there's Sarah. And there's Sarah.
And also this one. And there's Sarah. I mean, I don't mind.
Yeah. But yeah, so where can people find you if they want to follow you and learn more about your content?
I am pretty much only on Instagram. It's at Deconstructing Purity Culture. All the other social medias that are not just like my personal ones feel too overwhelming. And I will soon be on a podcast with Megan, I think it's Shantz. I can never remember how to pronounce her name and I feel really bad about that. But I've been on her podcast, tearing apart some Christian women's books and we're about to start Every Woman's Battle. So,
you told me about this. Oh my yes. God. No, I think that's such finally a cool finished podcast it. Idea. That's so fun to yeah. just like dive.
It's just like, part of like, oh, sorry.
Oh no, no, just to dive into Christian books and like
yeah.
break it down.
It's part of like, her podcast already, and she asked me to do it with Captivating, and it took us 4 episodes. And so Every Woman's Battle is probably going to take us a few, but that's like the main
places
that I am.
Unpack Made to Crave. No one ever talks about it. No one talks about it, and it's single-handedly like gave me an eating disorder.
Yep.
Someone has to talk about it. I tried to talk about it on my TikTok, and no one knew what the fuck I was talking about. And I was like, how have you guys not read this? This thing ruined my life. Like, what are you talking about?
It taught me that my eating disorder was godly.
Literally. And I already had like eating disorder habits. Yeah. And then that just like that book solidified the shit out of them.
Yep.
Lisa Turker should not be able to write anymore. She should have her
I know.
Pen and paper should be taken away. Yeah. Taken away. She shouldn't have it anymore. she's totally like reoriented to the way that she writes. But she hasn't gotten any fucking heat from Made to Crave. I've never seen anybody like actually giving her heat for it. And it's like this about bitch gave a whole bunch of children eating disorders. Like somebody needs to talk to her. Like this is not okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah, send me links for that because I would love to listen, obviously. And then I will have all the links in the episode notes so all of you guys can listen. But thank you again for coming on and taking the time. Like I said, welcome back at any point, anytime.
I appreciate it. It's so fun.
Well, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please write us 5 stars on iTunes and leave us a review. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram at Mindful Minds Pod. We have a new username. And then you can also visit us online at mindfulmindspod.com and serafinablog.com. You can also follow me on TikTok at Fina_Bina, FINA_BINA for all of my deconstruction and deconversion content. As always, to end our time, unclench your jaw, take a deep breath, and remember, you can always learn, you can always grow, and you can always choose to live your life in a more mindful way. I will chat with you guys in 2 weeks.